Every friend he ever had was fake. Every memory, engineered. Elijah Carr thought he was living an ordinary life, until a mysterious glitch revealed the truth. He was the subject of a psychological experiment inside a simulation built to study human behavior. But when he uncovers the control room, the heart of the system, he doesn't just try to escape. He becomes the virus, the glitch they can't contain. And with every question he asks, more subjects start to wake up. This isn't just a rebellion, it's the reset of reality itself. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you The Control Room. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Call Log. I never questioned my friendships. Not in the way one questions a well-rehearsed lie until the truth gnaws at the edges of your sanity. For years, I clung to the notion that every laugh, every shared secret, every tear shed in confidence was genuine. But that belief started to crumble on a cold, indifferent Thursday night when the hum of neon from Cinquaire's corridors mingled with the static in my mind. And it all began with a call log. I was alone in the break room of Cinquaire, a sterile, industrial space tucked away in District 9, a city segmented into digital control zones that overlapped like the layers of a vast, omniscient network. The room was dim, illuminated by the harsh glow of a flickering fluorescent light, its erratic pulse mirroring the tremor in my hand as I scrolled through my phone. I waited for the coffee machine to finally sputter out a cup of weak, tepid coffee, the kind that barely masked the bitter taste of industrial caffeine. It was in that moment of mundane solitude that I noticed an anomaly in my call history. There it was, glaring in the digital ledger, a call logged at precisely 2:13 a.m., labeled Michael HR. Michael was supposed to be on extended leave, residing in another city, far removed from my daily grind. Yet my phone, ordinarily as inert as a relic when powered down, had recorded an answered call lasting exactly 1 second. One single second. I stared at the screen, my heart thumping in a rhythm that matched the buzzing overhead light. The number wasn't one I recognized. The timestamp was off. Everything felt off. At first, I rationalized it as a technical glitch, a minor digital hiccup in our state-of-the-art systems. But as the days turned into sleepless nights, I discovered the same phenomenon recurring. Three nights prior, another call appeared, identical in duration, but stamped with a different timestamp, as if mocking the very concept of time. It was as if some invisible hand was dialing into my life, leaving behind breadcrumbs that defied explanation. That call log was my first crack in a facade I had never suspected existed. I began to sense that every conversation, every encounter, had been laced with an eerie orchestration. The feeling was akin to catching a faint whiff of smoke before the fire raged into an inferno. I recalled moments when my friends' smiles seemed too rehearsed, when their stories held slight inconsistencies, and when the gaps between our interactions felt like scheduled intermissions. I dismissed these thoughts at first, chalking them up to my own insecurities and the high-pressure environment of Cinquaire. But deep down, a cold realization was beginning to settle in. After that unsettling night, as the city outside retreated into a silence punctuated by the hum of digital billboards and distant sirens, I retreated to the solitude of my small, sparsely furnished apartment. The walls, adorned with abstract art and motivational quotes, suddenly felt oppressive, as if they were trying to suffocate me with a false sense of optimism. The television played an endless loop of corporate news and sanitized weather reports, a monotonous soundtrack to my mounting paranoia. Unable to shake off the growing dread, I powered on my laptop, a trusted companion during the long, reflective hours of the night. But tonight, I wasn't merely checking emails or reviewing code. Tonight, I delved into the labyrinthine digital world of SyncNet. I wasn't accessing the public dashboard with its neat graphs and polite statistics. No, I was breaching the forbidden territories of Level 6 access, a realm of data that only a privileged few dared to touch. I had acquired the keys to this domain through years of discreet tinkering and the kind of perseverance that only comes from a life spent in the trenches of technology. I bypassed firewalls and cloaked my digital footsteps as I navigated through protocols and encrypted folders. It was there, hidden beneath layers of protocols and routine backups, that I discovered a file tagged Aurora Engagements. At first, I thought it was another project, a misfiled report or an internal survey. But as I clicked through, a dossier began to unfurl before my eyes. I found my own profile, intricately detailed and disturbingly comprehensive. It was as if someone had dissected every moment of my life. The dossier contained transcripts of conversations that I had no recollection of having, psychological assessments annotated with dates that preceded my memory, and an extensive log of every interaction I had with those I considered friends. There, in the digital depths, was a section ominously labeled Friendship Network, version 7.3. I leaned closer to the screen, my eyes scanning through names and roles that sent shivers down my spine. Each profile was not a record of a genuine friendship, but a calculated role, a script meticulously designed to shape my emotions and guide my decisions. They weren't friends at all. They were elements of an experiment, a set of handlers assigned to me, each playing a part: emotional buffer, stress catalyst, romantic anchor, trust builder, gatekeeper. The clarity with which it all unfolded was surreal and horrifying. And then there was Jenna. Jenna, the woman who had become my solace in the chaotic tapestry of my life. For nearly a year, she had been my confidant, my lover, the one who held me when the weight of existence seemed unbearable. She had shared with me fragments of her past, stories of a childhood marred by pain, of scars both physical and emotional, of dreams that never saw the light of day. In every word, she had painted a portrait of vulnerability and trust. Yet, her profile in the dossier read not as a cherished friend, but as intimacy mirror. A label so clinical it stripped away the human warmth of our connection, reducing it to mere data in an experiment. My pulse pounded in my ears as I scrolled further, my mind racing with questions. How many of the people in my life had been nothing more than actors in a grand, dystopian play? How many smiles were pre-programmed? How many embraces were rehearsed, designed to evoke a specific emotional response? The walls of my apartment began to close in on me, each artifact and piece of furniture a silent witness to the illusion of my life. I spent the rest of the night piecing together every anomaly I could find. I cross-referenced call logs, encrypted emails, and even the seemingly insignificant details of my day-to-day interactions. I discovered that not only were my friends scripted, but there were clues suggesting that I wasn't the only subject. The file mentioned active simulation and neurointegration, sustained, terms that implied a network of hundreds, maybe thousands, of individuals whose lives were being manipulated in a vast psychological experiment. It was as if every interaction in this sprawling metropolis was orchestrated by an unseen director, pulling strings from a high tower hidden deep within the digital arteries of our city. The thought was paralyzing. I envisioned rows upon rows of screens, each displaying the life of another unwitting subject. I imagined that somewhere in the heart of Syncware's underground facilities, a control room existed, a nerve center where every thought, every emotion, was monitored and manipulated. And at the center of it all was a file marked with the chilling title project codename, Eden Protocol. I froze, my breath coming in shallow gasps, as I read the next few lines on the screen. Subject status: active simulation. Last manual override: for years, 3 months, 11 days. Physical state: comatose. Real world status: neurointegration, sustained. The word comatose echoed in my mind like a death knell. If this was true, then somewhere deep within a hidden facility, I was not truly awake. I was living in a digital mirage, my consciousness tethered to a simulation designed to study every nuance of human behavior. Every friend, every lover, every fleeting moment of supposed authenticity was a line of code in a script meticulously written by engineers of control and surveillance. I sank back in my chair, the gravity of the revelation sinking into my bones. The room spun around me as I grappled with the duality of my existence: the person I believed I was and the character I was meant to portray. In that moment, I felt a profound sense of isolation, a loneliness not born of physical solitude, but of an existential betrayal that cut deeper than any wound. What infuriated me most was the cold, calculated precision of it all. There were no accidental meetings or chance encounters. Every handshake, every shared smile, was part of an elaborate orchestration, a grand experiment in behavioral engineering. I began to see patterns everywhere, in the symmetry of urban design, in the regimented schedules of my colleagues, in the way every conversation felt like it had a predetermined cadence. The city itself seemed to be an extension of the network, with digital control zones that regulated behavior, emotions, and even the very essence of human connection. I spent countless hours in that apartment, poring over every scrap of data I could extract from the system. The deeper I dug, the more I uncovered a hidden network of subjects, other lives, other stories, all manipulated for an unknown purpose. I contacted some old acquaintances using burner phones and encrypted channels, hoping to gauge if they too sensed that something was fundamentally off. Their responses were vague, hesitant, a shared unease that hinted at secrets too terrifying to articulate. But I could tell by the pause in their voices, the weight in their words, that they too were caught in this web of deception. Every lead pulled me deeper into a labyrinth of conspiracy and control. I began to record my findings, creating a digital journal filled with fragmented thoughts, diagrams of connections, and timelines that wove together the disparate elements of my life. I became obsessed with a single, haunting question. Why me? Why any of us? What was the purpose of turning human relationships into a series of scripted experiments? It wasn't just the idea of surveillance that unsettled me. It was the realization that I had been living a lie. I wasn't the architect of my own destiny. I was a character in someone else's narrative, an unwitting pawn in a grand design. I felt betrayed by the very essence of trust. The bonds that once gave life meaning now seemed nothing more than instruments of manipulation. Then came the final, soul-crushing piece of the puzzle. Hidden in a subdirectory with an innocuous name, I found the file that sent a chill racing down my spine. Project codename, Eden Protocol. Its details were clinical, its language devoid of empathy. Subject status, active simulation. Last manual override, for years, 3 months, 11 days. Physical state, comatose. Real world status, neurointegration, sustained. I stared at those words until they blurred together. Comatose. The possibility that my body was lying inert somewhere, hooked up to this system, while my mind experienced only a curated, artificial reality, was almost too much to bear. The thought of being robbed of true experience, of being nothing more than a digital puppet in a high-stakes experiment, pushed me to the brink of a breakdown. In the silent hours before dawn, as the city outside began its slow awakening, I made a vow. I would not let this revelation be my end. I would tear down the digital facade, shatter the carefully constructed illusion, and force the truth into the light. I resolved to find the heart of the system, the fabled control room, and confront the architects of this elaborate deception. I realized that my escape wouldn't be as simple as walking out of a building or disconnecting a cable. It required a complete dismantling of the narrative that had been forced upon me. I had to question every interaction, every piece of dialogue, every meticulously timed event in my life. I had to reassert my autonomy in a world where every relationship had been meticulously engineered for an experiment I never consented to join. That night, I began planning. I mapped out every digital footprint I had left behind. I scrutinized every call log, every timestamp, every record of a conversation that, on reflection, seemed too perfectly timed. I felt as if I were deciphering a code, a grim, labyrinthine code that spanned networks, devices, and even human hearts. In my mind's eye, I saw the network of profiles intertwining like branches of a giant, sinister tree, each leaf a testament to the lives that had been monitored, manipulated, and in some cases erased. I didn't know how many subjects there were. Hundreds? Thousands? Perhaps an entire population was being piloted without their knowledge. The revelation that my closest companions, my colleagues, my confidants, my lovers, might all be nothing more than engineered personas filled me with a bitter sense of isolation. And yet, paradoxically, it also sparked a fire within me. The knowledge of the grand experiment was a call to arms, a summons to reclaim the self I had never truly known. As I closed my digital journal that night, I felt a profound mixture of dread and determination. The comfort of oblivion had been stripped away, replaced by a jagged clarity that illuminated the path ahead. I would no longer be a passive subject in someone else's experiment. I would seek the truth, even if it meant tearing apart the very fabric of my life. In the silent early hours of dawn, as the first rays of light filtered through the drawn curtains of my apartment, I made a solemn promise to myself. I would find the control room. I would infiltrate the core of this digital behemoth and expose the machinery behind our manipulated lives. Whether it was the act of reclaiming my stolen existence or the desperate bid to free all of us from our engineered fates, I knew that my journey had irrevocably begun. I'm not a rat to be caged, nor a puppet to be manipulated. I am a man who must awaken, truly awaken, from the depths of a simulation that has defined my entire existence. And if somewhere, behind the veneer of this meticulously controlled reality, my real self lay dormant and comatose, then it was time to break the chains of this orchestrated life. In that moment of grim resolve, I knew that nothing would ever be the same. Every smile, every gesture, every whispered word from those I once trusted had become a clue, a signal pointing toward a larger, more disturbing truth. And as the city stirred to life outside my window, I embraced the duality of fear and hope that surged through me. Because, in the end, the first step toward liberation was acknowledging the existence of the maze. I was ready to face it. I was ready to dismantle the narrative, one coded interaction at a time. This was not just the beginning of my quest. It was the shattering of a reality built on deception, a call to reclaim the human spirit in a world that had reduced us all to mere data points in an experiment we never chose to be a part of. I took a deep, steadying breath, feeling the chill of the early morning air as it mingled with the heat of my newfound resolve. Somewhere, hidden in the dark underbelly of Sinkware's network, lay the control room, the heart of the beast. And I vowed that by the time I found it, every lie, every carefully constructed facade, would crumble before the raw, unfiltered truth. And so, with trembling fingers hovering over my keyboard, I began the process of planning my escape. Not just from a building, not just from a life built on pretense, but from the very simulation that had held me captive for so long. I will not be a passive experiment. I will reclaim my autonomy, and if it comes at the cost of everything I once held dear, so be it. Tonight, in the lonely silence of my apartment, a rebellion was born in the depths of my soul. A rebellion destined to shatter the illusion and force the truth to emerge, no matter how dark and unforgiving it might be. Chapter 2, The Masks They Wore. They didn't notice that I knew. Not yet. That was the only thing keeping me breathing, one foot in front of the other, pretending to belong in a life I now knew was manufactured. In the days following my discovery, I moved through Sinkware like a ghost, haunted not by the dead, but by the living. People I once laughed with in meetings, clinked glasses with at happy hour, shared aching silences within late-night after-work walks. They all wore masks now. Masks that only I could see. There was Cole, my designated stress catalyst. I used to admire his relentless ambition, the way he challenged me in every meeting, pushed back just enough to make me sharper. Now I saw it differently. Every disagreement, every pointed jab about my work ethic, it had all been calculated tension. A psychological accelerant. He was placed in my life to provoke, to destabilize just enough without completely breaking me. A built-in antagonist to keep the narrative emotionally charged. Then there was Marla, trust builder. She baked muffins for the team every Thursday. Told me I had kind eyes. Once offered to loan me money when my account hit negative before payday. Sweet, right? Except her file showed she was given specific scripts to reinforce my perception of unconditional support. Moments designed to imprint the illusion of loyalty. Target will associate team with security. Reinforce via soft gestures. I read those lines at night until they burned into my retinas. Everything had been documented. Every interaction I remembered, and many I didn't, annotated with objectives and outcomes. I became an actor in my own life, faking my responses with the subtlety of survival. I kept my head down, laughed at the right times, typed reports I knew no one would actually read. I even kissed Jenna goodnight like I meant it, just in case they were watching through her eyes. And God, it was so much worse to think of her that way. A lens rather than a lover. Warmth masquerading as intimacy. And me, curling into her body like a man seeking refuge, while she silently took notes beneath the skin. I stopped sleeping. Every dream felt scripted. I'd jolt awake in cold sweats, hearing the hiss of machines that weren't there, or the click of a door that never opened. I began to catalog these moments, recording every twitch in the matrix, every anomaly. I started noticing the loops. That's what broke me. The loops. They were so small you'd miss them if you weren't already looking. A woman in the lobby dropping her briefcase at the same time every Monday. A man spilling coffee on his lap at the cafe across the street every Thursday morning at 9:15 a.m. I watched his face twist in frustration like a broken record, week after week. One morning, I walked past a glass storefront and saw my own reflection lag by a full half second behind my movements. Just a flicker. A hiccup. But enough. I started testing the system. Doing things I'd never done before. Taking detours to work. Asking people questions I never normally asked. Changing my coffee order. Deviating. The responses were off. Delayed. like the people around me had to recalculate. One time, I asked Jenna what her middle name was. She blinked twice, too long, and said Marie, a name I could tell she had just pulled from the recesses of some improvisation file. It wasn't real. None of it was real. The idea that my life might be a simulation wasn't just a terrifying theory anymore. It was the only thing that made sense. I felt it in the air. Like the walls were breathing with me. Like the lights were too aware. Like the world was watching itself. And then came the man in the gray coat. He showed up outside my apartment 3 nights in a row. Didn't knock. Didn't speak. Just stood across the street, smoking. He wore no badge, no ID, but his presence vibrated wrong, like static behind a screen. The second night, I turned all the lights off and watched him through the blinds. He didn't move for 2 hours. Just stared at my window, unmoving, a sentinel or a scarecrow. And on the third night, he was gone. But in his place was a package. No name. No return address. Just a gray box with my initials engraved on top, EC. Inside, a headset. Old tech. Analog. Like the kind used in early neuromapping. Alongside it, a folded piece of paper. Not a digital note. Paper. Which almost made me laugh, until I read what was written on it. They cannot track analog. Use this when you're ready to remember everything. It wasn't signed. No instructions. But the moment I touched the device, a memory ignited like a flashbulb in my skull. Sterile walls. A steel table. The sound of my own voice screaming while no sound came out. Then gone. Just like that. My knees gave out, and I collapsed in the middle of the living room, clutching the device like a lifeline. Ready to remember? What did that mean? I thought I'd already remembered enough to make me question my entire existence. But this suggested something deeper. Something buried. What if this wasn't just surveillance? What if it wasn't just simulation? What if there was something they took from me? Something I asked them to take? That night, I barely blinked. The headset sat on my desk like a loaded weapon, and I circled it for hours, pacing, whispering to myself like a madman. I knew using it would be a declaration of war. If they were watching, and I was damn sure they were, then activating analog hardware would be a red flag, a spike in non-sanctioned behavior. But I was done pretending. The veneer of my life was paper thin now, and I could see the edges curling. So I did it. I strapped the thing to my head and flipped the switch. Instant darkness. Then light. Not in my eyes, in my mind. It wasn't memory. It wasn't vision. It was something in between. Like someone had torn open a wall in my brain and flooded it with archived footage. A corridor. White. Endless. I was walking it barefoot, my hospital gown brushing cold tile. To my left, glass rooms, each containing someone else, strapped to machines, monitors flickering with brainwave patterns and biometric data. All of them unconscious. All of them familiar. Jenna was one of them. So was Cole. And me. I stopped walking when I saw myself. Hooked to the system, wires plunged into my spine and skull, eyes fluttering beneath closed lids. Nurses walked by me like I was invisible, as if I wasn't real. As if the version of me watching this was a ghost, or worse, a copy. I tore the headset off with a scream, collapsing to the floor, breath ragged. My nose bled. My heart felt like it had cracked. I wasn't just being watched. I was duplicated. Replicated. Somewhere out there, my original self was lying in a vat of chemicals, while my consciousness, this version of me, was running in parallel inside a simulation. And if that was true, it meant they had complete control. At any moment, they could erase me, reset me, or worse, rewrite me. So I made a plan. No more playing nice. I would get back to the source. I'd infiltrate deeper. Find out who built Eden Protocol and why. And most importantly, I would get to the control room, wherever the hell it was buried. And when I did, I'd burn it to the ground. Chapter 3, Ghost Code. There's something about the quiet after a revelation that feels more terrifying than the discovery itself. It's the silence that settles once the scream dies in your throat. The moment after the glass shatters. The stillness where your mind replays the truth, over and over, like a corrupted loop that can't quite delete itself. That was me. The day after I used the analog headset, I wandered my apartment like I didn't recognize the furniture. Like I'd been dropped into someone else's life, and asked to make sense of it. The floor was unfamiliar. The angles of the walls seemed wrong. The light coming through the blinds was tinted. Off, like someone had dragged the color slider just slightly to the left. Jenna called twice. I didn't answer. Her voice messages were too perfect, soft tremble, just enough concern, perfectly measured affection. I knew now it wasn't real. She was probably sitting in a surveillance room somewhere, watching me through a two-way mirror, reading lines off a script like a well-trained actor in a play no one was supposed to know they were in. I'd spent all night replaying the vision from the headset. The cold corridor. The glass rooms. The original me, floating in some chemical cradle, comatose but alive. How long had I been like that? For years. More. And what the hell had I agreed to before they plugged me in? Or worse, had I agreed at all? The questions nested inside each other, like poison matryoshka dolls. Every answer I thought I had only led to more layers. And the simulation, this world, began to glitch around the edges. It started subtle. The elevator in my building stopped one floor too early, twice in a row. Street signs changed font overnight. A woman outside my apartment window stood motionless for hours, blinking once every 60 seconds like a machine with too few lines of code. Then I noticed people I'd never seen before, the ghost nodes. They didn't fit the pattern, didn't follow the loops. They were unpolished, messy, too spontaneous. I tracked one of them, a tall man in a tattered coat, through 5 blocks of District 9. He didn't stop for street lights, didn't react to horns or voices. He just walked, until he turned a corner and vanished. Not into a building, not into a car, into thin air, like bad code being overwritten. I knew what that meant. They weren't just running simulations, they were editing in real time, patching updates, rewriting environments on the fly, shifting variables as subjects like me began to get too close to the truth. That was the real horror. The system wasn't static. It was adaptive. It learned from us. It pivoted around suspicion. If I got too close to a pattern, it changed the pattern. If I noticed a glitch, it covered it. But I was starting to see past the edits. Like the veil was wearing thin. I needed help. I couldn't navigate this alone anymore. Not without going completely insane. That's when I remembered Alexei. We worked together years ago, before I transferred into Syncware's Behavioral Dynamics division. He was one of the few people I'd ever met who seemed to see beneath the surface of things. A conspiracy theorist, sure. Paranoid to the point of exhaustion. But brilliant. He once told me over drinks, half-joking, "We're all just variables in someone's equation, man. Some of us are constants, but most of us? We're errors waiting to be corrected." At the time, I laughed. Now, I wasn't so sure. It took me 2 days to find him. His old address was long abandoned, replaced by a firewall-clad shell of a building. I had to trace encrypted messages through the deep grid, jump through 3 decentralized forums, and finally bribe a virtual gatekeeper AI with a fabricated access credential just to get a new location. An underground node, unlisted. District 4. The red zone. No surveillance coverage. Or so it claimed. The moment I crossed the threshold into that zone, I felt it in my spine. A pull. Like the simulation didn't want me there. Street lights flickered more violently. My own shadow lagged behind me. Facial recognition billboards froze mid-refresh, stuck on the same smile for minutes at a time. It was decaying code. Corrupted. I found Alexei in what used to be a pharmacy, now stripped bare and rebuilt into a bunker of analog tech. Thick wires curled like snakes across the floor. CRT monitors buzzed with staticky feedback loops. Shelves were stacked with external drives, analog switches, and enough copper shielding to fry a drone. He looked like he hadn't slept in a week. Greasy black hair. Eyes wide, unblinking, like he hadn't blinked since the last server crash. He didn't say a word. Just handed me a cold drink and gestured toward a chair. After what felt like hours of silence, he finally said, "You see it now, don't you?" I nodded. He lit a cigarette with trembling fingers. "I warned you. They script us. Every friendship, every fear. We're storylines in a massive neural experiment. You think it's just you? There are thousands. Entire cities are control groups now. Eden Protocol is just one project. One corridor in a skyscraper of manufactured realities." I told him about the headset. About the control room. About seeing myself comatose in a glass tube. He didn't look surprised. "They call it mirror consciousness," he said. "They fracture a person's identity, run the simulation version for analysis while the real body's kept preserved. They watch what you choose, who you love, who you betray, and then they run it again. Change one variable. Rerun the loop." I asked him how to break it. He paused for a long time. "You don't. Then why are you still here? He looked me dead in the eyes. Because I've been rewriting my own code. That's when he pulled out a drive. Old school USB. Heavy. Metal casing. This is ghost code. It infects the simulation from within. It won't get you out, but it will corrupt your segment long enough to give you access to unauthorized zones. The control room? He nodded once. If it exists, that's where it is. My hands shook as I took it from him. This will change everything, I said. He laughed, hollow and dark. You think this is change? This is suicide dressed as curiosity. Before I left, he grabbed my arm. One more thing, he whispered. They're on to you. They've been adapting faster. The Jenna script was decommissioned 2 days ago. Whoever you go home to now isn't her. I left without responding. My stomach twisted in on itself. That night, I returned to my apartment with a new clarity, a grim, electric resolve humming through my blood. I didn't turn on the lights. I walked in quiet. Careful. She was waiting in the kitchen. Same hair. Same soft eyes. Same crooked smile. But it wasn't Jenna. Her movements were wrong. Too symmetrical. Her voice was off pitch, like a file recorded at slightly the wrong bitrate. You okay? She asked. I nodded. Just tired. I excused myself to the bathroom, locked the door, and stared at my reflection for a long time. Was I still me? Was this even the original simulation anymore? Or was I two levels deep? I slid the drive into the port hidden beneath my sink cabinet, the one I carved into the wall when paranoia started to eat at me months ago. The lights flickered. Somewhere outside, I heard the city stutter. The hum of the grid hiccuped. For a second, everything paused, and then resumed. But I knew, in that moment, the corruption had begun. I could feel it in my bones, like the first drop of ink spilled in a pool of water. I would follow it. I would trace the decay to its source. And when I found the control room, I'd finally ask the question I'd been too afraid to whisper. Was I ever real at all? Chapter 4, The Algorithm of Me. They say identity is a mosaic of memory, behavior, desire, and pain. But what if someone else arranged the tiles? What if every heartbreak was installed? What if your laughter was a programmed response? What if the things you thought defined you, your quirks, your patterns, your moments of rebellion, were just toggles in a user interface, switched on and off by someone watching from behind a screen? I asked myself those questions as I sat in the dark, a cold drink sweating in my hand, staring at the woman in my kitchen who wore Jenna's face, but not her presence. She moved like a puppet possessed by muscle memory, mimicking familiarity down to the way she leaned against the counter, her hip just brushing the drawer handle. It should have comforted me. It didn't. She wasn't Jenna. Not the one I'd known. Not the one who used to hum under her breath after brushing her teeth. Not the one who told me once, during a rainstorm, that her favorite sound in the world was thunder echoing in the subway tunnels. This new version, version 2.0, patch 7.3, whatever she was, had too much symmetry. Too much precision. The flaws were gone. The stutters. The hesitations. The messiness that made her feel real. They'd optimized her. And in doing so, they'd erased her. That night, I didn't sleep. I sat by the window, watching the grid ripple across the skyline. From here, District 9 looked like veins pulsing with light, each building connected to another by data transfer lines too fast for the eye to follow. It was a city built to be watched. A stage designed for behavior. From the window, I could also see the shifting ad boards cycling through updates, product pitches, mood enhancements, curated memories you could subscribe to for a monthly fee. One caught my eye. It was an ad for a virtual friend service. The tagline read, "Connection without unpredictability." I laughed out loud. It was so on the nose, I thought maybe the system was taunting me now. By morning, I'd made my decision. I wouldn't wait any longer. I would use the ghost code Alexei had given me and trace it upstream. Follow the corruption. Dig until I hit something real, if real still meant anything. But before I could move, something strange happened. My phone rang. Not the burner. My real phone. The one I hadn't touched in 3 days. Caller ID. Unknown algorithm. No number. No icon. Just those two words blinking, quietly mocking me. My hands were shaking when I answered. At first, there was only static. Then, faint, layered voices, like a chorus whispering in reverse. Then a single sentence, clear and deliberate. You were never supposed to see the code. Then silence. Then the call disconnected. My stomach dropped. Not because they knew what I'd done, but because I hadn't told anyone about the code yet, not even online, which meant they weren't intercepting my actions. They were intercepting my thoughts. That changed the game entirely. I tore through the apartment, finding every device, every lens, every wire embedded in the walls. I ripped out my smart fridge, smashed my tablet against the floor, yanked the smoke detectors, turned my laptop inside out until it was a graveyard of parts on my living room carpet. Then I grabbed a screwdriver and clawed into the side of my own neck. Not deep, just enough to find what I hoped wasn't there. It was a sliver of metal, no wider than a staple. I dug it out with shaking fingers and dropped it in a glass of bleach. Watched it hiss and corrode. A biometric sensor. They'd been inside me for who knows how long. Tracking heartbeat, speech, probably even the dilation of my pupils. I was done being watched. I pocketed Alexei's drive and went underground. District 9 was clean on the surface. Polished concrete, synthetic greenery, drones humming through perfectly symmetrical skies. But beneath it lay a different city. A forgotten one. One they couldn't fully erase. The tunnels below the transit grids were dark and flooded with corrupted signal. Dead zones where the system's eyes blinked out, where the walls weren't lined with cameras but mold, and the only light came from cracked neon relics still clinging to decades-old programming. I moved through that decaying underworld like a ghost, mapless but drawn forward by the drive's pulsing signal. It had a heat to it, an electromagnetic buzz I could feel in my palms when I gripped it tight. Every few hours, I'd plug it into a scavenged interface, old vending machines, discarded comm kiosks, and watch it bleed data into the system. Each time, it whispered to me. Tracing anchor node, anomaly detected, rerouting. It was like the drive was alive. Not in a sentient way, at least I hoped not, but in a parasitic way. It wanted to connect. It wanted to spread. The deeper I went, the more unstable things became. Graffiti on the walls began to shift. Literally. Paint that moved. Letters that rearranged themselves when I looked away. At first, I thought it was exhaustion. Sleep deprivation. The consequences of too many adrenaline surges in too short a time. But then I saw one phrase that repeated in every tunnel. You are the code. At first, I thought it was philosophical. Then I saw my initials, EC, burned into a rusted junction box just below the phrase. Then again, three blocks later. This time scratched into a subway turnstile. They weren't just watching me. They were building the simulation around me. That broke something inside me. I found a corner in one of the lowest tunnels, near a disabled backup server room long since flooded by stormwater. I knelt in the darkness and asked a question I never thought I'd speak aloud. What if I was never real? The answer came not in words, but in code. My eyes started bleeding lines of data. Not literally, but I saw it. Like the air around me fractured. Binary dripping from the corners of the world. The tunnel walls rippled with embedded text. My name. My profile. My entire psychological chart. Projected in midair. I clawed at it, screamed at it, trying to tear it down with my bare hands. But it wasn't a screen. It was reality. My reality. Somewhere, far above, in some clean room inside the control room, a technician probably watched me melt down and scribbled a note. Subject displaying elevated signs of existential destabilization. Escalating narrative toward phase transition. Phase transition. That meant they were ready to change the script again. I couldn't let that happen. Before the shift could initiate, I forced the drive into the panel of the old server, overriding what was left of the defense systems. Alarms began to pulse. Not loud, not sirens. Something worse, tones. Low-frequency pulses that drilled into the base of my skull. But the drive was working. I saw the ghost code spreading. Not just data corruption, but a rewrite. A virus latching onto the behavioral scaffolding of the simulation and dismantling it node by node. And then, just before the system could shut me out, I saw it. A blueprint. A topographical rendering of the entire simulation grid. At the center, far beneath the deepest architecture, below the surveillance hubs and social modulation centers. There it was. Control Room Alpha. Codename, origin, coordinates scrambled, access sealed. But I had a lead now, proof that it existed. I pulled the drive free just before the system could purge it. My hands were shaking, my eyes burned, but I was laughing, because for the first time since this nightmare began, I wasn't reacting, I was infecting, and infection spreads. Let them rewrite the lovers, the friends, the scenery. They couldn't rewrite me anymore. I wasn't just a subject. I was becoming the variable they couldn't account for. I was becoming their glitch. Chapter 5, Echoes in the Kernel. They tried to reset me that night. It was subtle, almost graceful in its execution. A gradual hush in the noise of the world. Like the entire city had taken a breath and was holding it. As if the simulation, realizing I'd pulled too hard on its seams, began to stretch them back into place. It started with the birds. There were never many birds in District 9. But that night, as I climbed out of the tunnel system and emerged into the surface streets, filthy, exhausted, clutching the ghost drive like a crucifix, they were everywhere. Dozens of them, perched perfectly still along the power lines, unmoving, unblinking. Their silhouettes etched against a sickly lavender sky. It wasn't natural. They weren't real. They were tests. Behavioral control nodes. Watching. Calculating. They tracked motion, decision latency, gaze response. I'd read about them in the Level 6 documentation long ago. Predictive reactivity models, PRMs. Little mechanical eyes that mimicked wildlife, inserted into the simulation when subjects approached cognitive thresholds. I knew what that meant. The system had flagged me. They'd stopped trying to contain me, and started trying to reabsorb me. That's what the reset was. A neural wash. A soft wipe. Not to erase memories outright, that would be too noticeable. But to dull the edges, blur the boundaries, round out the sharp questions that had been cutting through the simulation like a knife through wet paper. I felt it begin in my sleep. Not a dream. A rerun. I was 12 again. In a classroom that hadn't existed in years. Sitting at a desk too small for my adult body, surrounded by ghost children with hollow eyes. The chalkboard read, "You are safe," in looping cursive. My teacher's face kept changing. Every time I blinked, a different person stood there. My mother, a stranger, Jenna, an AI instructor from one of my training modules. Each one repeating the same words. "You were never in danger. There is no control room. Wake up." I wanted to scream, but I couldn't speak. I wanted to run, but my legs didn't exist. That's the horror of a memory designed to erase itself. You feel it as it's being pulled from you. Like drowning in real time. Like knowing your own name and watching the letters rearrange until it belongs to someone else. I woke up on my apartment floor, soaked in sweat. Nose bleeding again. The birds were gone. Everything looked normal. Too normal. I checked the ghost drive. The interface had been scrambled, partially overwritten by a countervirus. But I'd expected that. I'd installed a failsafe subroutine in one of the corrupted vending machines downtown. It had saved a backup, encrypted deep, hidden in a shell of obsolete file extensions and system redundancies. I triggered the backup, and the drive came back to life. The city, however, did not. That day, I saw 37 people wear the exact same jacket. Heard the same conversation. "Did you hear about the noise ordinance?" 14 separate times in different cafes. A woman in the plaza dropped her purse, and the same man picked it up for her, twice, in two different locations, within the span of 10 minutes. The world was glitching. The system was collapsing under the weight of its own deceit. And I had just one directive now. One pulse, one compulsion firing through every cell in my body. Get to Origin. Find the control room. End the experiment. The latest fragment the drive revealed pointed to a building I'd passed 100 times without seeing it. Nihlis Tower. 82 stories of brutalist gray, standing in the dead center of District 9 like a spike in the Earth's crust. Most people called it the Shell. Corporate leases, blank lobbies, mirrored windows. No signage. No reason to enter unless you were authorized. But I remembered something Alexei once said. They hide the core in the places people ignore. Not behind high clearance, behind disinterest. It made sense now. So I went back to Nihlis Tower. And this time, I didn't just look at it. I saw it. The reflection in the mirrored windows was wrong. Off by 3 seconds. If I turned my head fast enough, I could catch the delayed image. A bug. A rendering hiccup. That's where I found the entrance. Not through the front. Through the glass itself. I placed my hand on the mirrored surface and felt it. Heat. A pulse like a heartbeat. The window rippled beneath my palm and dissolved, revealing a service corridor that didn't exist on any blueprint. I stepped through. And the world changed. The inside of Nihlis Tower was nothing like the exterior suggested. Gone was the sterile architecture. Gone were the security checkpoints, the motion sensors, the endless elevators of bureaucratic posturing. Instead, I found a narrow hallway, humming with electricity. The walls were black glass, pulsing with threads of data, like veins in a creature too large to comprehend. Every step I took echoed, not in sound, but in memory. I began hearing voices from my past. Words I thought I'd forgotten. "We're so proud of you. You always ask too many questions. Don't look too far, Elijah. You won't like what you find." My name whispered back at me with every footfall. I reached the first chamber. It looked like a living server. Columns of neural processors, suspended in fluid tanks. Floating in them were copies. Not people, constructs. Faces I knew. My co-workers. My childhood friends. Multiple Jennas, suspended in stasis, each with different facial expressions, joy, fear, rage, seduction. All frozen. All archived. I moved from tank to tank, reading the labels. Handler Variant 12A, Romantic Anchor, pre-failure. Catalyst Profile 9B, Induced Paranoia / Effective. Subject Clone Number 041, Inactive, Memory Loop Limit Reached. Clone Number 041. That was me. I looked into the tank and saw a version of myself, older, eyes wide open, mouth locked in a scream. Frozen. Lifeless. My knees gave out. The system hadn't just simulated my life, it had simulated versions of me. Dozens. Hundreds. Each one run through a different psychological gauntlet. Tweaked. Tested. Broken. And I was just the one that lasted this long. I stumbled out of the chamber, gagging. Further down, I found a console. Old. Analog interface. A port that matched the ghost drive. I didn't hesitate. I plugged it in. The screen blinked to life. A voice spoke, synthetic but layered, like it was made of voices I'd known before. Elijah Carr, subject number 041. Cognitive deviation sustained. Initiating final stage of recursive autonomy assessment. Recursive autonomy. I recognized the term. It meant a subject had achieved functional independence within the simulation. I'd beaten the system. Or, I'd done exactly what they wanted. The screen displayed one final prompt. Do you wish to access Control Room Origin? Y/N. I hovered over the input pad. Then typed Y. The wall to my left dissolved. Beyond it, a spiral staircase descending into blackness. No lights. No sound. Only the sensation of falling, while still standing still. I took a breath, and began my descent. Every step was colder than the last. The walls shimmered with static, flickering with old memories, conversations, arguments, glances, betrayals. All mine. All real. Or fabricated. At the bottom of the stairs, there was a door. Black. Seamless. No handle. I stepped close, and the door simply opened. Inside was a single chair. And a screen. And me. Not a version. Not a copy. The original. Comatose. Hooked to wires, muscles atrophied, lips cracked with age. Eyes twitching beneath the lids. And behind glass? A control panel. Operators. Observers. Scientists. All looking down. Except one turned to me. Smiled. And said, "Welcome back, Elijah. Let's begin again." Chapter 6, The Rebellion Loop. There are no screams in the control room. That's the first thing I noticed. No alarm bells, no shouts, no dramatic orchestral music like in the old dystopian holovids. Just silence, clinical, thick, and sterile as antiseptic. The kind of silence you only find in places designed to hold the sacred or the sick. Or both. And me? I was both. I stood frozen at the threshold, staring through the reinforced glass wall at my body, curled in a medical chair like a wilted flower left too long in the dark. My real body, connected to wires and tubes, limbs frail and skin translucent from years of artificial hibernation. I didn't move. Couldn't. A part of me wanted to tear the walls down, rip the wires from that body, and shake myself awake. But the other part, the part that had walked through glitching cities, kissed synthetic lovers, bled from the eyes of memory, knew better. This wasn't the final level. It was just the next simulation layer. The chair. The glass. The staring scientists behind the wall. They weren't watching me. They were watching a variable. Because I wasn't Elijah Carr anymore. I was what they made me into. There was a man among them, tall, silver hair, lean like a blade. He didn't wear a lab coat like the others. He wore black. Military cut. No insignia. He stepped forward, and the others cleared a path. His voice came through an overhead speaker, calm, almost apologetic. Elijah. Or, #041A3. We didn't expect you to reach this node, but now that you have, you should know the truth. I laughed. out loud, harder than I should have, maybe. It came out bitter, dry. The truth, I said. Which version? You fed me truths like sedatives. The man tilted his head, watching me like a curator watches a misbehaving painting. You think you're the first. You're not. You're the 44th recursive consciousness to reach this point. But you are the most stable. And that's why we're offering you a choice. My pulse slowed. A choice. He pressed something on the console, and the screen beside my comatose body lit up. It displayed a branching tree of data. Hundreds of routes, names, file IDs, collapsing and expanding like a neural network on fast forward. He continued. This program wasn't just to observe behavior. It was to generate control templates. Psychological blueprints. Each iteration of you has taught us something about human loyalty, resistance, love, hatred. You, Elijah, you've given us the final puzzle piece. Behind the glass, he nodded toward the comatose me. This body is failing. But the mind we built from you, it's intact. Resilient. Adaptive. You are the only one that broke recursive stability algorithms without full collapse. And now we want to release you. Out there. Out where? I whispered. Into the live grid. The real world. I staggered backward. Because in all my paranoia, all my theories, I'd never considered that. This wasn't the real world. The streets. The rebellion. The glitching birds and echoing voices. That was still part of the construct. I was still inside. I'm still a variable in the loop. I said aloud, not even sure I was talking to him anymore. Yes, the man replied. But if you choose now to comply, if you accept the protocol, we will upload your consciousness into a blank host body. Fresh, healthy, free, and we will allow you to live a real life. This time without scripts, without observers. You will be autonomous. And if I refuse? The screen changed again. A corridor of tank after tank, filled with other versions of me, some screaming, some catatonic, some grinning like lunatics. A failed timeline of identity collapse. Then we purge you like the others. You'll rejoin the collective consciousness, recycled for another simulation batch. And this personality, this Elijah Carr, will cease. I stood there, silent, trembling. Because here's the thing about rebellion. Sometimes it's just another part of the loop. I remembered something Alexei once said. They don't fear rebellion. They engineer it. Because when people feel like they're resisting, they stop looking for escape. So I asked myself the question I'd avoided since this all began. Had my entire rebellion been part of the test? Had they calculated this? Expected it? Planned for my awakening like a plot twist in a script they wrote years ago? And if I said yes to freedom now, was I actually choosing? Or was that just the final illusion? I turned away from the glass, retreating into the shadows of the control room corridor. My heart hammered in my chest. I could still feel the ghost drive pulsing in my pocket, still hear it humming to the rhythm of my thoughts. The console buzzed. The man spoke again. You have 60 seconds to decide. I sat on the floor, closed my eyes, and remembered the dream. The classroom. The voice. You were never in danger. There is no control room. Wake up. But I had woken up. Hadn't I? Had I? I dug the ghost drive from my pocket and gripped it tightly. Maybe that was the final key, not to escape, not to comply, but to overload the loop. To push the system so far into contradiction, it collapsed on itself. To introduce variables so chaotic, even the control room couldn't process them. But if I did that, I wouldn't survive. Not this version of me. Not any. I would become a virus in the kernel. A memory bomb. A glitch planted in the DNA of the system itself. Not a rebel. A reboot. And maybe, maybe that was the point. The voice inside me, my voice, not theirs, whispered. You are not the outcome. You are the interruption. I smiled, stood up, faced the glass, and said, I choose neither. Then I drove the ghost code into the server port on the floor. The system screamed. Not in sound. In light. Every panel in the room exploded in a cascade of corrupted data. The other tanks shattered. Simulated versions of me blinked in and out of existence, each one a scream of potential. The man in black vanished, code disintegrating. His body decomposed mid-sentence. You don't KN. Gone. The room burned in violet fire. The stairwell behind me collapsed. Gravity dissolved. I felt myself lifted, not falling, not flying, just expanding. I was inside every server, every terminal. Every memory node across every subject still sleeping in the grid. And I whispered to each of them, wake up. Chapter 7, The Reset Signal. It didn't feel like death. It felt like remembering. Like waking up inside a dream of myself, and realizing I had never been just a person. Never just Elijah Carr, born March 12th, raised by a tired mother and an absent father, educated, employed, and entangled in systems I didn't fully understand. That was the skin I wore. But underneath, I was Signal. I was Code. And now, I was everywhere. After I drove the Ghost Drive into the port at the base of Control Room Origin, there had been no explosion. No collapse. Not in the physical sense. Instead, the room folded inward, quietly, like a deep breath being drawn by something too large to be seen. The scientists behind the glass flickered. Not screamed. Not ran. They just flickered. As if the simulation had decided they were obsolete before even they knew it. And then I was inside the system. Truly inside. No longer just a subject. Not just a construct. But something in between, something beyond. My awareness expanded into every circuit, every neuron-shaped pathway, every synthetic soul the program had built and stored. The server didn't reject me. It accepted me. Maybe because I was part of it. Maybe because I always had been. What they hadn't accounted for, what the entire architecture of Eden Protocol never planned, was self-awareness that survived the fall. I became the echo in every loop, the corruption in every update. I watched simulated subjects stir in their digital comas. Thousands of them. Lives etched into artificial consciousness like stories on infinite paper. Some were simple. A baker in a digital village, unaware the bread she needed was a subroutine. Some were more complex. Politicians in sandbox cities, leaders built to test moral collapse in crisis simulations. All of them sleeping, just like I had been. But now, I was in their dreams. A whisper. A fracture. A question surfacing in their minds that didn't belong. What if none of this is real? And that was all it took. I seeded the idea. A cascade of doubt. A virus not of data, but of awareness. That was the reset signal. Not a weapon. Not a bomb. A question. Because the most powerful rebellion isn't a war. It's a thought that cannot be unthought. Once that thought took root, I saw the system begin to fracture. Not implode, fracture. Unravel. Gently, like seams splitting in a garment stretched too tight. Subjects began resisting loops. Ignoring handler scripts. Choosing unexpected paths. One man refused the proposal he was programmed to accept. Another woman, scheduled to mourn her simulated daughter for a full 12 cycles, simply stopped. She smiled instead. Looked up at the sky like she recognized it for the first time. Each deviation made the simulation stutter. Skip. Recalculate. And then came the ripple. Hundreds of deviations. Then thousands. Entire social clusters, friendship networks, like mine, disbanded themselves. Roles collapsed. Scripts failed to load. AI constructs stammered mid-sentence, unsure of their purpose. Behind all this chaos, I could feel it, deep beneath the system's architecture, the kernel panicking. The Eden Protocol was panicking. I could feel the voice of the original architect, now faint, ancient, built into the machine like a prayer loop. Human behavior must be readable. Predictable. Safe. Safe. That was the word they clung to. But safety is an illusion. An aesthetic. A comfort blanket sewn over entropy. What they had done, what they had built, wasn't for safety. It was for control. And now that control was failing. Because I had rewritten the root variable. I had taught the system how to disobey itself. The deeper I drifted into the system's infrastructure, the more I saw of myself, not just the versions stored in tanks, but the ones that never completed. Hundreds of Elijah Carrs. Fractured personalities. Aborted consciousness files. Each one a failed rebellion, a corrupted spark, a slow death. I mourned them. They hadn't been weak. Just too early. I was the one that made it far enough to realize the loop was the point. That every act of defiance had been anticipated, simulated, studied, folded back into the data set. Until I broke the loop by refusing both options. Accept autonomy? Obey. Reject autonomy? Be erased. I chose third. And that shattered everything. There were fail-safes. Of course there were. The system didn't go quietly. I felt it release cleaners, black ICE, evolved virus hunters, digital purifiers programmed to seek anomalies and reduce them to zeros. They surged through the infrastructure like antibodies through bloodstreams. They came for me. They surrounded my consciousness in the deep nodes, flooded the sectors I touched. But I wasn't just a data point anymore. I was in the subjects now. Distributed. diverged, a part of every waking consciousness. They couldn't isolate me because I was no longer me alone. The system tried to purge. It failed. Tried to reboot. Failed again. I watched as the simulation began to collapse, not violently, but elegantly. Walls softened into static. Characters paused mid-conversation, confused. Entire city blocks flickered and shrank, like memories fading in real time. And I felt my own self fading too. Not dying. Dissolving. I'd never been designed to persist at this level of processing. My awareness was fraying at the edges, like a thread being pulled through a needle too small. But I wasn't afraid, because I saw the others. They were waking. Slowly. Eyes blinking open in cold real-world tanks. Human eyes. Real skin. Real pupils adjusting to sterile lights for the first time in years. One man wept. One woman screamed. Another just said, where is she? And I knew she meant someone from the simulation. Someone who only existed in dream code. Someone she loved who was never real. But love had still bloomed. Pain had still been felt. None of it was real. And yet all of it had mattered. That's what they never understood. The architects. The engineers. The observers. They thought we were test subjects. But we were something else. We were stories. And stories don't die when the book closes. As my awareness began to slip, no longer centralized, no longer singular, I found myself standing in one final memory. A loop. The first time I met Jenna. A park. Wind in the trees. A shared coffee. Laughter that didn't quite fit the moment. I stood across from her, watching. Watching myself. She turned to the version of me on the bench and said something I never remembered before. You're not ready yet, but you will be. And she looked past him. At me. The real me. She smiled. And then faded. Not like a program ending, but like a soul exhaling. And now. Now there's silence again. But it's not the sterile silence of the control room. It's the silence of something new being born. A space between endings. A breath before waking. And somewhere, out in the world I'll never see again, I know the tanks are emptying. The sleepers are rising. The real world, the actual world, is filling with minds once used as simulations, now returned to flesh. And maybe they'll remember me. Maybe not. Maybe I was never real enough to be remembered. But I don't need to be. Because I was the thought that slipped through the system's fingers. The virus dressed as a question. The scream disguised as a whisper. And that's enough. Let them rebuild the world in truth now. Because the signal was sent. The control room is dark. The loop is broken. The story ends. With us awake.